Fosamax, an inhibitor of bone resorption, binds to hydroxyapatite and impairs osteoclasts' ability to resorb bone. In this way, Fosamax builds bone at both the spine and the hip, and histological studies show that the bone formed is of normal quality. Fosamax is the first non-hormonal agent shown in clinical studies to build healthy bone and dramatically reduce vertebral fracture incidence. In these studies, Fosamax built bone at both the spine and the hip. In fact, 96% of patients achieved increases in spinal bone mass, and therapy with Fosamax was generally well tolerated.
Few first-time events in racing history unfurled their colors with so much exposure and controversy as the 1996 running of the U.S. 500. Many racers found themselves in unfamiliar surroundings for the first time on Memorial Weekend Sunday. Each racer had his own thoughts as he prepared for the 500-mile ordeal. Would the car hold up? Would his engine allow him to run with the competition? Had the crew prepared the machine flawlessly? Was every piston firing precisely? Every tire staggered properly? Every ounce of data analyzed correctly? For ESPN and the U.S. 500, I'm John Fleming. Let the tradition begin. The story of sail is well told. From trade routes to the merchant galleons and exploration to the edge of the earth, ships in the sea long held the honor as humanity's connection. Through these wonders and the brave men who sailed them, the world grew. Then these upstarts, Americans, invented a better way, a faster way to use the wind and the sea. In 1840, America's New England set out to the world a gift, the design of a ship unlike any seen before, which spread across the seas and soon was the preferred connector of people, places, and products. They became the stars of sail. They made their way out and made their way home, and the world became smaller.
He started as an unskilled laborer, and then later on when we started to know each other, we were on a first-name basis. I don't know whether I could call him Václav today, but I used to. He never talked much. He was terribly quiet, private. I don't know, I think partly because he didn't want to make trouble for anybody. Because we knew in any case that his every step was watched. His house was under permanent surveillance.
Even though he didn't really want anything to do with it, Bud was an old friend. So on the way back to the store, Nick's dad went to Bud Lawrence's office. "Tom, good to see you," said Bud. He stood up and walked around his desk to shake hands. "Have a seat." Tom sat down uneasily, and Bud pulled another chair over. "Ever seen Westfield so stirred up about anything in your life? You and Ginny must be pretty proud of that boy of yours." Bud couldn't remember Nick's name. Tom shifted in his chair and nodded. "Yes, he's quite something, that's for sure. But I tell you, Bud, I'm ready for it all to just die down and blow away. Too much fuss." Instantly, Bud saw how to get what he wanted. "Well, Tom, I'm afraid it's not really going to go away. Looks like something started up, and people are real interested. You probably saw those bright red ballpoints around town with the word Frindle on them. That was my doing, just testing the waters." The dinner was a small, informal affair, and there were only two other women present. The original châtelaine of the chateau, who was living on the grounds in a small cottage, was a countess, old enough to be Victoria's mother, and very polite and pleasant. The other woman was the wife of one of the colonels visiting the general from London. None of them had been able to get away in months, and it was a relief to see new faces. The conversation was mostly about the war at dinner. Edouard was very proud of Victoria. He could see that both the general and the countess were impressed. And as he drove her back to the barracks, he said, "There's something I want to say to you, Olivia. I don't want there to be any misunderstandings between us." But as he said the words, she felt a familiar ache in her heart, where it had been wounded before, and she could feel her whole body stiffen. She said it for him. "You're married," she said, entirely without emotion.
What makes you say that?
He was totally startled. I just knew.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Horse Heaven, a dramatization of the short story by Louis L'Amour.
A short time later, Marshal Jeb Rawlins came in, told Marge to go home.
Thank you, Marge. You did a good
thing
here.
Patted me on the shoulder and told me to let her know if I needed anything.
All right.
I wanted to tell her to get me a ticket on the first train east. I dug my fingernails into my palms and pulled myself together as the Marshal settled into the swivel chair behind his desk.
Please accept my deepest sympathies, Mrs. Lachlan.
Thank you.
This kind of thing I know is, well, it's hard to understand why life happens this way.
Someone must have tried to rob him.
Well, they got him on his way over the ridge.
He wanted to get across the flats before it got too hot.
He was shot 3 times. Oh. His rifle and pistol weren't found. Whatever money he had was gone, too.
I told him not to carry so much.
I know. I've already sent a telegram to the sheriff in Raton. One of his deputies is on his way. He'll be here tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Cecil Burroughs will take him up to the ridge and show him where the body was. Oh. Maybe they'll find something.
George was a good man.
Yes, he was. Go home. Get some rest. We'll talk later.
Thank you, Marshal.
You know, our show is full of little visual tricks like this, which is why tonight we're debuting a brand new segment entitled Late Show Optical Illusions.
On a recent episode, Dave appears to be providing some kind of entertainment. But a quick shot of the audience reveals that no entertainment is taking place whatsoever. It's just another one of those amazing Late Show Optical Illusions.
Okay.